Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Later on in the show, we'll hear a piece from our correspondent, Cheryl Hosler, the roving naturalist, as she tells us tales of wildlife rescue and rehabilitation and the many misconceptions people have. Sometimes their well-meaning intentions turn out disastrously for the wild animals and birds. But first, our conversation with Adam Weymouth, author of the new book, Kings of the Yukon. Of all the species of salmon found in Alaskan waters, the Chinook, or king salmon, is the most prized for its oily, nutrient-rich meat. Adam's a British journalist who decided to use the salmon's epic 2,000-mile journey back and forth to their spawning grounds in the glacial streams of Canada to the mouth of the Bering Sea to learn about what's really going on with the complex ecosystem there. So Weymouth started at the spawning grounds in Canada and paddled his way all the way to the oceanic environment where the adult salmon mysteriously spend their lives. But while the salmon are the reason for the voyage, the real discoveries made by Adam were the stories of the people, some native and some transplants, that depend on the salmon fishery in part for their very lives. We spoke with Adam via Skype in Portugal. Adam, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Before we get into the book deeply, I'd like to know, how did you first get interested in exploring nature in this kind of way? Were you into paddling and exploring rivers before this trip?
No, the paddling came as a bit of a shock, actually. I sold the idea for the book before having spent much more than about a day in a canoe. And when I realized that someone wanted me to write it, I ended up having to learn how to paddle quite quickly.
Wow, so you had literally no experience paddling a canoe and then decided to spend an entire summer paddling across, you know, the far north from Canada through Alaska to the mouth of the Yukon.
Yeah, pretty much. I'd done long journeys in other ways before. I walked from England to Istanbul a few years ago. So the idea of doing long journeys, that was an 8-month trip, was quite familiar to me, but the canoeing was new, and the rivers that we've got to practice on in Britain are tiny little streams in comparison to what the Yukon is.
And what got you interested in this particular story in paddling the Yukon to study the Chinook salmon, the kings of the Yukon, as you call them?
I first went to Alaska in 2013. I was on a grant as a journalist to write about stories of climate change and resource extraction. And I sort of followed my nose around the state, really. There's no shortage of stories about climate change and resource extraction in Alaska. And a man called Mike Williams, who was at that time the chief of the Nupik Nation, invited me to come and visit him in his village called Akiak, out on the Yukon Delta. And all the flights that go to Akiak have to route through Bethel. And while I was there, Mike said I might as well sit in on this trial of these 23 Yupik fishermen who were having a hearing for having gone out and fished kings at a point when there was a ban on the fishing of them. So that was when I first came across the story and started to see on quite a small scale how the disappearance of the kings, or the Chinook, was impacting on one group of fishermen, one indigenous group in one small part of Alaska, and started thinking about a way to see how that was affecting the entirety of the Yukon River.
And so maybe you could give us your elevator speech here. Pitch us the story of you're going to paddle the Yukon in to tell the story of the salmon fishery, right?
So the idea was to paddle from the Yukon River is the longest salmon run in the world. And some of these king salmon will travel 2,000 miles from the mouth of the river up to the source. So the idea was to paddle the exact same distance that the furthest of these salmon travel, starting at McNeil Lake in the Yukon Territory in Canada and paddling down 2,000 miles at the same time that the salmon were coming up on their final migration, stopping at a lot of indigenous villages, cabins, fisheries projects, commercial operations, all the rest of it along the way, and seeing how people were dealing with the massive decline in king salmon that was now happening.
So, what was it about the Chinook salmon fishery that captured your attention and made you decide to make it the focus of this story?
Even when I travelled in Alaska the first time in 2013, I came to see how wrapped up the story of the Chinook was with a lot of different people that live on the river, whether that's indigenous people going out subsistence fishing, or whether that's a family jumping in the car for the weekend and going and getting their 40 fish to last them through the winter, or whatever it might be. And I started to see that talking to people about the salmon would bring up other questions about how they thought about food, or how they thought about their kids' future, or why they chose to live where they do. And it's such a vast subject. Trying to get any sort of handle on how the North is changing and how it's being affected by climate change and globalization, all these issues. The salmon seemed an interesting lens to try and look at all those issues through.
And as you paddled from the source essentially in Canada to the mouth of the river in Alaska, tell us about some of the effects that you saw of climate change, not only on the landscape, but on the people.
It's climate change is hard to write about because it's not this dramatic story. It's the ways that people are living it is the that is in their day-to-day experiences. One of the things that I was hearing from people that are living on the river is the access to the subsistence foods which they go out and get are becoming more and more difficult to obtain, whether that means that the ice is thinner on the river now, so hunting and traveling on the river on winter is more difficult. It might mean that the seasons are slightly different now to how the animals migrate, and so the geese are coming at a different time of year. It might mean that whilst there are still strict hunting guidelines on when, for example, you can go out and shoot a moose, those guidelines are now coming at a time when the moose have not yet come down from the hills. And so it's really starting to affect people's day-to-day existence. On top of that, the permafrost that's melting is one of the major effects that's happening on the Yukon. So a lot of land which used to be permanently frozen is now starting to melt, which means that large chunks of the Yukon's banks are falling off into the river, which is altering water courses, making it harder to travel, and in some places, houses are slipping out of villages and falling into the river.
I what I really enjoyed your accounts of, one of the things I loved about this book was it's your classic narrative of an adventure, a travel story where you're traveling and, that day-to-day rhythm that you get into of paddling and camping and your experiences through the day of nature and kind of disconnecting from the civilized world, if you will. That was wonderful, and I really enjoyed that. But I think what stood out to me the most were the people that you encountered along the way and how connected they were to the land. Could you tell us about maybe a couple of your favorite people that you encountered?
Yeah, and I think that's important because I was probably drawn into Alaska in the first place with this idea of it being this untamed wilderness where I would travel for months on end and meet no one and live out my kind of Jack London fantasies. And of course, these places are populated and have always been populated. And it was absolutely the people that made the trip for me as well. And traveling in places like this, I found myself being welcomed with an incredible sense of hospitality, which still seems to exist on the river in places where travelers are pretty few and far between. I remember Mary Dementieff, who's a 80-year-old Athabaskan woman who still heads out from her village every year to make what they call fish camp a few miles downriver, who invited us in for the evening and played us some songs on the guitar and took me out fishing with her, and still makes the almost a pilgrimage to her fish camp every year, even though it's become increasingly hard to catch the kings now. And I was also fairly fascinated by a lot of the we stayed I've actually written about them all in the book, but we stayed with four different people that you have their own reality TV shows along the length of the river, of which Stansaray was one. And these are people often who've moved up from somewhere in the lower 48, or the outside, as they call it in Alaska, and might have moved there perhaps in the 70s, maybe dodging the draft from Vietnam, and found a cabin in the woods and liked what they saw and stayed, and are now living these incredibly self-sufficient, fairly subsistence lifestyles, but for perhaps 2 or 3 months of the year, a camera crew will turn up and dog their every move, making a program for National Geographic.
I was fascinated by those people in particular, because it seemed like for many of them, and of course, you know, obviously because they're there, they stayed. But once they stayed a winter or two, they were kind of, that was it. They were there for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, there's only something like 30% of Alaskans were born in Alaska. And the majority of those would be indigenous. And so everyone else seems to have been drawn to Alaska for whatever it represents them, whether that's making big bucks working on the oil platforms, or whether that's living a backwards lifestyle. And it seems like the one place where it's homesteading is not possible there anymore, but it's still fairly easy to obtain a cabin in the bush. And it seems like one place where you can still live outside of the rules and make your own rules and live the sort of life you've always dreamed about having, if you're of that persuasion.
You mentioned fish camps and Mary, could you explain to us what is a fish camp? Describe one of them to us.
So traditionally, and when I say traditionally, there's been a practice that's been going on for many thousands of years. Every summer when the salmon arrive, and when that is will depend on whereabouts on the river you are, families will move out of the village, or before, when it was a more nomadic lifestyle, they would arrive at the riverbanks at fishing spots which had been used for generations. Nowadays, when people are more settled in villages, they'll have a more simple cabin a few miles downriver, which they'll always go to, a corrugated shack built out of ply with some mosquito netting and not much else. And a family would go and spend maybe a month there, putting a net out, pulling it in every day, preparing the fish by cutting them, drying them, smoking them. And it was a place for the whole family together. So everyone has a job, and the kids will be learning by watching their elders how to catch the small fish and how to prepare them. And the elders will be there and teaching the kids. And it's a way for the entire family to come together, not just to get food, but to share culture as well.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll return to our conversation with Adam Weymouth. His new book, Kings of the Yukon, recounts his epic journey paddling a canoe along the last great salmon run in North America. And we're back. Let's continue our interview with Adam Weymouth, author of Kings of the Yukon. You're listening to Blue Dot from North State Public Radio in Northern California. One of the things I also found fascinating is, and I thought about you just the other day when I went to the local supermarket and I saw, you know, Atlantic farmed salmon with color added in the plastic packaging. Could you kind of give us a take on what you learned about the salmon that we tend to buy in stores compared to the salmon that you were experiencing and some of the tasting experiences you had there?
It's an entirely different fish, so much so that there is a new name, which has been coined for a new Latin name, Salmo domesticus, because its body has morphed so totally from what a wild salmon looks like. Alaska's interesting in that it's not allowed fish farms since the 1990s. But a lot of other places, British Columbia, Norway, Chile, have huge salmon farms, and the majority of the fish that we find at the supermarkets is now farmed salmon. Like you say, it's had the colour added to it because it's not eating the crustaceans and the krill and the sorts of things which colour the salmon flesh. Farmed salmon would be quite an unappetizing grey if it wasn't dyed various shades of pink. And particularly the kings, because they make this incredible 2,000-mile journey, they enter the river with these vast reserves of oil, which is their fuel, essentially, to power them up the river. So the wild salmon that you eat is absolutely dripping in oil to the point where I'd hear stories about people's smokehouses going up in flames because there was so much oil about. It's a rich, meaty, incredible flavor, and having eaten that now for 3 months, every person that we met along the river wanted us to share theirs, and because people are still able to go out and fish a little, and everyone wanted us to share their fish, and it's hard to go back to the farm stuff now, I have to say.
Well, I can imagine, and I love the fact that, you know, the salmon is becoming more and more difficult for these people to obtain, and yet they were so generous in wanting you to share it with them.
Yeah, it's still, there's a sense of abundance there still. And although the king is now much restricted, there are other types of salmon which come up the river and people are catching those as well. Although a lot of those salmon will not go as far. So when you get into Canada, they're not getting anything anymore. But yeah, the sharing of food, and not just salmon, but people would share moose meat and caribou meat and beaver meat and the berries that they gathered. There's a very strong culture of sharing as a way of welcoming guests.
And, you know, you mentioned that the other types of salmon, but it was interesting to me to think about the people at the beginning of your journey, 2,000 miles from the ocean. And those salmon have to make it through a gauntlet of fishermen and bears and eagles and whatnot, you know, to make it there. And could you talk a little bit about the attitudes that people have at the source compared to at the mouth at the ocean? Because, you know, they are all competing for the same fish.
They are, and despite being 2,000 miles apart, they are intimately connected by this river and by this fish. But to all other intents and purposes, they live far from each other. Some are American, some are Canadian. The Canadians are different indigenous groups to the Alaskans. And so whilst in some ways they feel like they really know each other, in other ways they don't know each other at all. And in some ways that I've experienced when I've done other journeys, people at one end are always very distrustful of people at the other end. And I found myself developing those prejudices as well. So I'd start up at the source and I'd hear all these stories about how the Alaskans are taking all the Canadians' fish, and they watch these TV shows and see their fish caches full of salmon every year and how unjust it is. And then as I moved further down the river, I just come to understand the Alaskan side of the story as well, and the pollution that was happening on the spawning grounds in Canada, which was affecting potentially some of the salmon coming down. And I'd understand, although at the source the idea that people would be making money from the salmon is unthinkable, going down the other end of the river and seeing the abject poverty which a lot of people are forced to live in, it's one of the poorest boroughs in the United States, you understand why there's a commercial use for this fish as well. There's a project which is hoping to restart again, where people from the source are taken down to meet people at the mouth and vice versa, to try and find some common ground and understanding.
Speaking of common ground, let's talk about the differences and cooperation going on, compare and contrast, if you will, The scientific method of managing the fishery by the fish and wildlife people in Alaska and Canada, the government officials who are determining, you know, when to allow fishing and when not to, compared to the management practices of these people who have lived with these fish for thousands of years.
Yeah, it's been a long battle to try and get scientific understanding to recognize traditional knowledge. And quite late in the day, scientific practices are starting to understand that the traditional knowledge has a place to play. There's one example of that is that NASA are now providing GPS tracking equipment and cameras for indigenous hunters out on the land to document their own experiences of climate change, because they're realizing that better than sending their own people there is giving it to people that are out on the land day to day, seeing the changes that are happening and are tapped into generations of experience of how that land has been and how it's changing. I think there is a useful synthesis to be found there. It was explained to me that the Western scientific tradition is about going very deep into something and studying, separating a part from the whole and studying that part very closely, whereas a traditional knowledge is more connected to a more holistic understanding. And I think both those ways of looking at the world have a role to play.
What were some of the things that from your journey, from the point you began, when did you first really feel like you relaxed into the rhythm of being on the river and on a daily basis? How long did it take to kind of disconnect from the civilized world that you came from to being on the river day after day? Because this took months, right?
Yeah, it was about a 4-month trip. I often find it takes a few weeks. I live in London, which is quite different from being in Alaska. And it wasn't just being on the river every day, but there were all sorts of other unknowns to adapt to. Like I say, I never really canoed before I went on this trip. There's suddenly big wild animals that I need to be concerned about, and the way that you keep your camp and look after yourself and cook is all very different from before. We had a lot of food that we were rationing, so there was a lot of logistics. And in the first few weeks, I was quite preoccupied with, you know, trying to get everything right and trying not to make a mistake. And then I think it creeps up on you, and it suddenly becomes the most normal thing in the world to be packing up for 2 hours every day after breakfast and paddling all day and unpacking again in the evening. And the readjustment back to London was in many ways more difficult than the adjustment to Alaska in the first place.
Well, I was just going to ask you that. How difficult was that to go from living that much simpler lifestyle, more connected to nature and our human roots in that, to back to, you know, one of the most urban places you can live on Earth?
I miss the constant sense of movement, certainly. Routine of getting up and packing and going every day and being in a new place each night. I miss that. The idea of being in nature in some way, I think it's easier to feel part of nature somewhere like Alaska, certainly. But in many ways, the notion that I had of this pure wilderness, the way that Alaska kind of markets itself, and, you know, Alaska's on every American's bucket list, it seems, and this idea that we can only really experience true nature if we go somewhere like this, I started to feel that that was something of a myth, and actually quite an unhelpful way to think about the environment. And although on the river I'd find myself, I'd intellectually know that I was 500 miles from the nearest road, in many ways it didn't feel so different from being in Scotland or being in some of the beautiful parts of the UK. And I think in many ways it helped me to relearn an appreciation of nature close to home. Just because it's more tamed and more populated doesn't mean that it's any less important or special.
Well, you mentioned wild animals, and of course anybody that goes to Alaska is going to have an awareness of bears, you know, because the grizzlies of Alaska are definitely not the black bears of California. They're dangerous. What was that a big concern? And can you tell us about a time when you actually did have a kind of a close encounter?
Yeah, I had a couple of close encounters, one of which I've written about in the book. Uli, my girlfriend, came to join me for the second half of the trip, and it was with her that we had it was very late in the evening. It's still light because it was almost 24 hours of daylight, but we'd stopped paddling about 1 o'clock in the morning, exhausted and ready to sleep, and just walking back to the canoe to start unpacking, we looked up and there was a grizzly not that far from us at all. Interesting that we both have quite conflicting memories of what actually happened. But somehow we managed to scare it off by puffing ourselves up and shouting at it, which I've been told is not what you're meant to do. And it ran off into the bush, and the whole experience must have lasted something like 10 seconds, but it left us with a very palpable fear. I really felt of myself as an animal. And they are a background preoccupation all the time. It would be easy to let a trip get ruined by them. And there's Alaskans that have spent hundreds of hours in the bush, and they all told us, you know, that you shouldn't let your trip be ruined by bears. But it is definitely always there in your back of your mind. I felt maybe like a herbivore must feel, that they know that there's a cheetah out there somewhere, but you can't be preoccupied all the time, you know.
And then what about the two-legged type of dangerous animal? Did you have any, you know, most of your experiences were very positive with the people you encountered, but did you have any experiences with sketchy folk along the river?
Everyone we met was very kind to us, but there were certain, there's a lot of alcohol around in the bush. A lot of the villages have voted to be dry, but in practice that doesn't really happen. It just means that the bootleggers are doing very well by selling very overpriced spirits. And there's a lot of drinking around. And the only times I really felt threatened by anyone was when I was around drinking. And generally I try to avoid drinking, just because it did often seem to come with these threats. And there's obviously a lot of guns around, and I'd heard a lot of stories. It seems to be a problem that's rife throughout Alaska, and I've never seen such a wide acceptance almost of alcoholism, and it's a really tragic thing to see.
Well, on the opposite end of that scale, I suppose, you went through a period of time, as I recall, where it was just raining and stormy and terrible weather. And then you came across what I found to be very odd, but it was, you know, perfect for you at the time, was like a Christian encampment.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a bit about those folks?
Yeah, absolutely, in the middle of nowhere. In fact, the next morning following the encounter with the bear, and I just looked at the map and said to Uli that I think we're probably the furthest on the whole trip we're going to be from anyone, and rounded a corner and came across about 150 children in as you say, a Christian Bible camp. Mostly Californians, although the camp's run by an indigenous pastor. And they were very generous to us, and they invited us in and let us have a room, and we went to the service with them in the evening. And I suppose there's something in me that's slightly hardwired to be skeptical about missionaries, and I don't know if that's fair or not, but a lot of these kids that we met definitely come from very difficult homes and troubled backgrounds, the ones that I spoke to really seemed that for those weeks of the summer, they'd found somewhere that they felt really safe.
I'm Dave Shlom, and you're listening to Blue Dot. After a short break, we'll wrap up our interview with author Adam Weymouth about his new book, Kings of the Yukon. Stay with us, and thanks for listening. And we're back. Let's resume our conversation with Adam Weymouth. His new book, Kings of the Yukon, chronicles his canoe trip down the length of the 2,000-mile river in search of understanding the last great and imperiled Chinook salmon run. And can you describe for us what these salmon are like? Because the Chinook, the kings, as they call them, really are an amazingly powerful and large fish. Could you give us a little description of what those fish were like when you had some close encounters with them?
It changes so much that it's hard to give a single description. The fish that live out at sea will spend their lives in the Pacific, and they're a bright silver. They're a lot smaller than they used to be. It wasn't uncommon in the past for people to be catching 80, 90-pound fish. The biggest Chinook ever caught was 146 pounds, an absolute monster fish. Now, and one of the problems with the Chinook is that it's shrinking, and now 20 pounds is a good fish, but 20 pounds is still a good-sized fish, and they're this almost burnished chrome kind of colour. Big, strong, muscular animals. But then as they enter the Yukon and they move from the salt water to the fresh water, as they start to head up on their migration for the spawning grounds, the whole shape of the fish will change. So the lower jaw will elongate and curve up to form a kind of hooked bottom lip that's called the kype. Skin will change color. So as they move closer to their spawning grounds, they'll turn from this silver to a pink to a sunset kind of red. And that's echoing changes that are happening within the fish as well, as all the organs shrink apart from the sexual organs. And so in the end, they're just these machines for reproduction when they reach the spawning grounds. And they use so much of their energy on these journeys upriver that just after they'll spawn, they all perish.
And what an epic adventure it is, 2,000 miles from the ocean to the spawning grounds for some of them.
It's absolutely phenomenal. And for the whole journey, and some of those ones that are traveling 2,000 miles, it might take them 4 months from entering the river to get into the spawning grounds. For the course of that whole journey, they won't eat or drink. So the oil that they've stored up in their bodies is all that they're using as their reserves to power themselves against the current for 2,000 miles.
Wow, and it's amazing to think you're paddling with the current, and what a difficult journey that is, and they're going against it.
Exactly. Some of the rapids we went down and doing this for months on end, it was amazing to think that, yeah, they're going the other way and with far less resources than we had.
What are some of the mysteries that are still exist? Well, some of the mysteries about the salmon and their lives, their life cycles in the oceans that we don't understand?
We still don't really know where they spend their adult lives. It's been very hard to follow them deep into the Pacific and understanding which parts of the Pacific they live in and how they know when to head back to the spawning grounds is still mysterious to us. And although we start to understand how they navigate now, we think that they move from the Pacific to the river mouth through using a mix of perhaps the stars, and perhaps they have some iron in their brains that they use as a kind of compass. And then heading up the spawning grounds, it's thought that they're navigating using their sense of smell, so they can pick out the exact mineral composition of their spawning ground from 2,000 miles away down at the river mouth. But how that's possible is still pretty hard to comprehend.
And of course, here on the west coast of the United States, we're seeing a virtual collapse of the Chinook salmon fishery. And that's one of the last places up there that still has a pretty strong Chinook fishery. What are when you talk to some of the scientists and the indigenous peoples, what do they think some of the primary reasons for the difficulties that the species is having?
Well, it's a different story on the west coast of the lower 48 in Alaska. The west coast has got fish farms, it's got huge dams, it's got polluted rivers, it's got deforestation and a lot of things which have affected the salmon, not just on the West Coast, but on the East Coast of the Americas and all across Europe and all across the Northern Hemisphere. One of the things I realized about Alaska, which I always knew was iconic for salmon, is that it's only iconic for salmon because that's pretty much the only place where it's left. And these runs that go into the hundreds of thousands, into the millions, used to be common all across the Northern Hemisphere. And what makes Alaska unusual and what makes the now decline of the Chinook even more mysterious is Alaska still does have a fairly pristine environment. It doesn't have fish farms. It doesn't have any dams. And so why the fish are starting to disappear there is almost more worrying in somehow, because we don't really know how to address it.
So after this trip and writing this book, what are some of the big takeaways that you have personally? What did you really learn from this entire experience that you want to share with people?
It's a nice time to be writing about the Chinook. I'm used to covering environmental stories that seem like a done deal and there's no hope left. And it's a nice time for the Chinook because it feels like at the moment they're hanging in a balance, but the way that we act in the next few years can really make a difference one way or the other. Since the big crashes in 2013, 2014, 2015, the management of the Chinook has been much better, and that very close management has been starting to edge numbers up ever so slightly. But at the same time, the very conservative management has meant that the indigenous people aren't really fishing, and that means that their culture is being impacted. They're not making fish camp. They're being forced to buy food from the store and so on. And so any solution that prioritizes fishing or preserving the salmon doesn't seem like it's going to work. It's going to need to be some kind of collaboration between everyone that's got cards in the game. And trying to think about environmental problems in general more holistically is to me how we need to be going about things. We've separated the parts out for so long that perhaps we need to start thinking more about that traditional knowledge approach of approaching things by looking at the whole system.
And of course, when we talk about fishing, you know, we're not talking about tossing a lure out and catching a fish on a rod. Could you tell us about some of the basic methods that are used commercially and by the indigenous people on the river to catch the fish?
So there's three main ways of catching your salmon. If you've got a good eddy, then people will do a set net, so a net that's attached to the bank and drawn out into the river and fixed to a buoy. And the salmon, which like to go into the eddies to have a bit of a rest from the current, will get caught in them there. Places on the river where it's wider, there'll be drift netting, so drawing a net behind a boat or sometimes between two boats to catch the salmon that are swimming up. And then there's a particularly ingenious contraption called a fish wheel, which, if you imagine almost a water wheel that's floating in the river, tethered to the bank and floating in the river, and generally made out of whatever people can find, bits of driftwood and chicken wire and all sorts of things. And that wheel will turn with the water's current. And as the baskets turn through the river, it will pick up the salmon that are coming past, and the baskets will funnel those salmon into a box.
Yeah, I found that really, really interesting. I'd never heard of salmon wheels before.
They came to Alaska about 100 years ago. They seem to have arrived with the gold rush, but they've been adopted by the indigenous now as much as by the incomers. And yeah, they're remarkable contraptions, and they're extremely effective as well. They're actually now used by some of the fish biologists who are doing research as well, because it's quite a good way for pulling salmon out of the water and tagging them and releasing them without doing too much harm.
And do you have any plans to return to the Yukon, or have you stayed in touch with any of the people that you met along the way?
Yeah, I have stayed in touch. We had a baby about 3 months ago, and I've just received some beautiful little mukluks in the post, made out of moose hide and from someone that we met in Fort Yukon. Yeah, we've had really nice connections with quite a few people, and I would love to go back. I'd love to go back and take the book back and travel through the villages again and talk to people about the book. It's felt important that the story is in some way collaborative, and that people do get to take back, and this is a meaningful book for the people that have contributed to it. So yeah, I think I'll be back one day.
Well, Adam Weymouth, I thoroughly enjoyed the book of Kings of the Yukon. It was a fascinating read, and what an epic adventure that you got to go on.
Yeah, thanks very much for giving me the chance to talk about it.
And I love the title. It reminds me of a 1940s old-time radio show, Kings of the Yukon, starring Sergeant Adam and his trusty husky Rex. I could just see you and Rex in your canoe paddling up and down the river, saving salmon and people alike.
I like it. Thanks a lot for having me, Dave.
Thanks to our guest, Adam Weymouth. His new book, Kings of the Yukon, is out this May. Next, we're going to hear from our friend Cheryl Hosler, the roving naturalist. Cheryl is going to give us her take on what can go right and wrong when people decide to intervene with injured or abandoned wild birds and animals.
It's baby season! Every spring and summer, wildlife rehabilitation facilities gear up to care for a wide variety of animals, especially babies, that are brought to their doors. I spent a summer working at a wildlife rehab center, and I'd like to share some of my experiences with you. Some are funny, some are sad, and you might just learn something. Many of the people who bring animals to our door mean well, but their intentions are stronger than their knowledge about wildlife. You've probably heard about people accidentally kidnapping baby bunnies and deer fawns under the assumption that animal mothers act the same way as human mothers. It's important to remember that many baby animals we think have been abandoned are actually just fine. Mother rabbits don't come to their nests very often to avoid attracting predators. Fawns are left in tall grasses because it's easier for them to hide while their moms browse for food. And fox kits are precocious and able to play on their own without parental supervision. These are all pretty common misconceptions rehabbers encounter on a weekly basis, but sometimes we get unexpected surprises. The man at the door says he found two orphaned ducklings and wants to turn them over to us. What he hands across the counter is a plastic dish filled with water. Two incredibly ugly, dinosaur-esque gray baby birds sit in the dish. We pull them out as soon as he's gone, desperately trying to dry them off and warm them up. Unfortunately, our best efforts aren't enough. One dies that day, the other dies 2 days later. Both had gotten water in their lungs. Baby mourning doves aren't known to be good swimmers. We don't fault the gentleman for trying to help, but less is usually more. If you find an animal that you think needs help, don't feed it or give it water. Please, let the professionals at a wildlife rehab take care of it. Rehabbers have been trained to care for these animals, who each require different conditions to be raised successfully. It's not surprising that many people have a hard time accepting the rhythms of hunting and death in nature. After all, we like to root for the underdog, and our brains are hardwired to protect cute things. So it's no surprise when a guy brings us a fawn and a story. Apparently, he was hiking in the woods when he came to a clearing where a group of coyotes were harassing a doe so they could separate her from her baby. He managed to scare the coyotes away, then picked up the fawn and brought it to us with bite marks and lacerations all over it. We did what we could, but the injuries were just too severe. Unfortunately for the mother deer, her baby was dead. Unfortunately for the coyotes, they hadn't gotten a meal out of it. But remember that we also get a lot of fawns that are accidentally kidnapped by well-meaning people. The guy called us up to say he had seen the doe wandering around in the same clearing as if she were looking for her fawn. My boss arranged for him to bring one of our kidnapped but otherwise healthy fawns out to the clearing, and the doe adopted it as her own. The ultimate lesson in wildlife rehab is to be flexible when opportunities present themselves. While wildlife rehabbers are trained to do what they can for their charges, no human can replace the instinctive care of a mother animal. Nigel is a beautiful white pelican. Prior to arriving at our facility, I'm sure he spent his days on rivers and lakes with his flock, catching fish and having an excellent pelican life. But somewhere along the way, he got his right wing caught and tangled up in fishing line. The more he moved around, the tighter the line got, until eventually it amputated his wing at the wrist joint. Luckily for Nigel, someone realized his plight, caught him, and brought him to us. Most likely due to his disabled state and discomfort at being at our facility instead of out in the wild, Nigel refused to feed himself. So it was the job of the staff and interns, twice a day, to feed Nigel as we nursed him back to health and found him a permanent home. If you ever have the opportunity to hand feed a pelican at a wildlife rehab, there are three things you need to know. Bring a friend, wear goggles, and you'll be going in up to the elbow, at least. Pelicans are quite a bit bigger up close than you might expect, so having an intern along with me to hold Nigel still was really important. Another unexpected quality of pelicans is the sharp hook on the end of the beak. The first time I went out to feed Nigel, I wasn't wearing eye protection. When he stabbed out with his long neck while struggling against our attempts to feed him, the hook on his beak hit me square on the lower edge of my right eye socket. I can honestly say that was one of the scariest things that's ever happened to me. And the elbow thing? Picture a pelican's pouch. They catch and store fish in there, but the place where the food actually needs to go so they can start digesting it is a part of a bird's throat called the crop. As we fed Nigel, I had to take each chunk of fish in my hand, put my whole arm down his throat, and slide the fish into his crop. Definitely a one-of-a-kind experience. Thanks, Nigel. The lady on the phone tells me her family found a young coyote on the side of the road. They think it's in trouble, and they've managed to get it into their car and are bringing it to us. When they carry the kennel up onto our porch, they tell me that the coyote pup was wandering down the shoulder of the highway alone, walking funny. My first thought is distemper, a neurological disorder not at all uncommon in coyotes, raccoons, and other carnivores in our area. Distemper is often mistaken for rabies because they present some similar symptoms, although they are caused by different microbes. Wild animals and unvaccinated pets can transfer the infection between one another. But no. I open the door of the kennel, and the juvenile coyote is shaking and coughing up blood, barely able to stand. She's obviously suffering. As my coworker comes up behind me, I realize the coyote must have eaten rat poison. My coworker's on the phone calling our partner vet as I bundle the coyote into the back of my car. If I can get her to the vet in enough time for them to administer vitamin K, we might be able to save her. I can hear her coughing and gasping in the kennel in the back seat, her breath gurgling as she fights for her life. My hands are shaking on the steering wheel. Do we have enough time to save her? Speed isn't really a thing when you're walking and carrying a dog kennel, but I make it from the parking lot into the vet's office on pure adrenaline. The nurse takes the coyote into the back and returns to the desk a minute later. We were too late. I don't know how this particular coyote encountered the poison. She could have caught and eaten a rat that had been poisoned, but it's not impossible to think that the poison might have been left out intentionally for her and other pest animals. A lot of people might not think it's sad that she died, since coyotes and other wild animals like them are often considered nuisances. All I know is that the suffering in that face will stay with me for the rest of my life. No animal deserves to die in agony. While it may sound like a lot of wildlife rehab is sad or frustrating, I want to remind you that it is truly important work that often results in happy endings. Wildlife rehabilitators are responsible for raising and releasing thousands of healthy animals every year, and our local environments are stronger for the effort they contribute. A family brings us an adult opossum in a cardboard box. They tell us she was dragging herself across their front yard in the middle of the day. I can see a series of old bite marks on her neck, and she doesn't seem to be able to move her hind legs. I suspect an infection and maybe serious internal injuries from whatever fight she had been in, probably with a dog or a cat. As we're examining her, we realize she's a mother. Tiny baby opossums are nestled inside her pouch. We give her some medication, lay her gently in a kennel, and give her a heating pad. When I start my shift at 6 a.m. the next morning, I have a sinking feeling in my stomach. The opossum's kennel is the first thing I check. She's dead. Her injuries and infection were probably too advanced by the time she was found. I carry her dead body to our examination table. the babies in her pouch are still alive. I have yet to come up with a satisfactory way to describe what happened next, but let me say it was one of the strangest experiences of my life. The inside of the opossum's pouch was warm and sort of sticky, moist, but none of those words really explain the texture. Opossums are strange mammals because they have an odd number of nipples, 13. This mother opossum had one baby for each nipple. I pulled out all the tiny, dehydrated babies and gave them fluids. Over the next few months, the baby opossums grew and flourished in our mammal room. 6 wound up making it to adulthood and being released. While it was sad that their mother died, I am incredibly proud of the work we did to rescue and raise those opossums. In fact, I'm incredibly proud of all the work we did at the Wildlife Rehab Center. The days are long, the work is loud and hot and often dirty, but the people who choose to care for orphaned, sick, and injured wildlife care deeply for their charges and for the people who bring those animals in for care. If you have a chance, consider donating some time or resources to your local wildlife rehab. I can guarantee they need it, and you'll be doing the Earth a service.
Thanks to our correspondent, Cheryl Hosler. Check out her YouTube channel, The Roving Naturalist, for her take on our interactions with the natural environment. And thanks to our guest, Adam Weymouth, author of Kings of the Yukon, available at all the usual places. And thank you for listening. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org and subscribe to us, Blue Dot, on NPR Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.